The Guardian.
Hello, I'm David Brindle, and this is the Charity Effectiveness Podcast, brought to you by Society Guardian in association with knowhownonprofit.org. Coming up in this month's programme...
You know, I think this is the most exciting time for the fundraising sector because extreme times breed extreme results and people are being forced to be creative, forced out of their comfort zones, and the biggest challenge is that they won't actually rise to it.
The recession, public spending cuts and the role of individual giving. We assess the state of the fundraising sector.
They're competing on the high street with other stores to some extent. They have to be professional in order to get their customers in. They do a very good job, and people enjoy shopping in charity shops, and I think that's why they're so successful.
Secondhand or vintage, where do charity shops sit these days, and what's their place in the fundraising mix?
Somebody in the charity sector has to accept responsibility to actively explain to journalists why charities use face-to-face, and not be afraid to challenge their ridiculously naive preconceptions that charities should not spend money on fundraising.
Why do chuggers and other fundraisers get so much bad press? That's all coming up in the Charity Effectiveness Podcast. Corporates, legacies, major donors, trusts and foundations, and rattling that tin. There's a wide variety of sources of funding for UK charities. But when it comes to decisions about targeting your fundraising resources, which vein is the richest? Which will give you the best return on your investment? Does the economic cycle dictate strategy? The recession has inevitably impacted on the sector, but as the economy slowly recovers, where should charity fundraisers position themselves? And then there's innovation. What's new and what's had its day? How important are online, social media, and texting in the overall scheme of things? Joining me today in the studio to discuss some of these issues are Clara Avery, Head of Supporter Insight and Development at Macmillan Cancer Support, Peter Storey, Director of Marketing at Kidney Research UK, and Martin Brooks, Chief Executive of New Philanthropy Capital. That's a consultancy and think tank dedicated to helping funders and charities maximise their impact. Hello to you all.
Hi.
Hi.
Clara, let's start with you. Last year, Macmillan raised more than £123 million, with fundraising counting for more than 90% of that income. What are your priorities right now?
Right at the moment, we're tussling with the fact that in the next 15 years, the number of people living with cancer is going to increase from 2 to around 4 million. So the need for our services is going to dramatically increase at a time when actually the public services that can deliver against some of those needs are going to be cutting back. So the call for funding is even louder than it ever has been before. So at a time when things are going to get challenging, we need to step up to the mark.
Peter, is it the same at Kidney Research UK?
Well, we have a pretty ambitious target. We want to double our income and treble our impact on kidney disease. We have kidney disease in this country growing at a rate of 5% every single year. 47,000 people at the moment are being treated for kidney failure. It's a fatal condition. The interventions are hardly the best things to live with. And we're just determined to pour some more money into research to try and find cures for this debilitating condition.
And Martin, as we crawl out of the downturn, where do you think charities should be looking to maintain their incomes?
I think they've got to worry very seriously about public spending cuts, and that's going to hit and hurt a lot of charities enormously over the next sort of 3 to 5 years. And they need to do more really to nurture private giving. Private giving has been pretty stagnant in the last 10 years or so, and lots of people have indeed stopped giving at all. And I think what charities have done is really shift some of their focus away from private donations and towards the public sector. And that trend is really going to hurt them over the next few years. They've got to rekindle private interest in charitable giving.
Well, earlier in the summer, we went along to the Institute of Fundraising's National Convention to gauge opinion among frontline fundraisers. And this is what people felt were their biggest challenges at the moment.
My name's Karen Rothwell. I'm Director of Marketing at the RSPB. Well, I guess the big news is the recession and the impact of the government spending cuts. And I think the landscape for delivery of all sorts of things that charities currently do with support from the government and through government agencies is going to change dramatically over the next few months. And so at the moment, I think people are watching, trying to read the rooms and predict what might happen.
My name is Mike Crossley. I'm the Director of Marketing at PDSA. That's a difficult one. From our point of view, we're an animal welfare charity, and I think it's probably gaining cut through, particularly when we are confronted in a very competitive environment and we face up against the health charities, the charities that look after children. Animals come somewhere down the line. And I guess our other big problem is just an ageing population, a population who have been used to giving to charity.
My name is Marcia Dover and I'm from the National Trust. With people feeling uncertain about whether they're going to have jobs or what the impact of the new budget will have, they're holding on to their checkbooks and purses a little tighter these days. So I think the charity sector has to pull out all the stops to make sure that their donors and supporters feel confident that they trust them so that they'll continue giving the support to their favourite charities.
My name is Alan Clayton. I'm Director of Clayton Burnett, freelance creative and Chief Executive of Relationship Marketing. How to awaken a new generation of people who behave differently to their grandparents, are just as motivated to do good things but do it in a different way. So getting to understand Generation X, if you like. The biggest potential is integrating people's lifestyle change with giving money to good causes, so where they actually change their behaviour as well as give.
Peter, do any of those concerns ring true with you?
Yeah, it's interesting about sort of, you know, the recession affecting people's willingness to give. I think certainly in our experience, the value that people have been giving, certainly to Kidney Research UK, has, if anything, increased during the recession. And without blowing our own trumpet, we kind of put that down to the fact that we have tried to look after our supporter base. We have tried to keep them engaged with us and close to us by keeping them informed about what we do. We have found, obviously, some pressure on acquisition, getting people to come to our charity anew and give to us for the first time. But I think, on the whole, pressure on individual giving hasn't been as marked in our experience as perhaps sort of general view has been.
Clara, your role at Macmillan specifically deals with identifying and knowing more about your supporters. How do you make sure they keep donating to you?
The key challenge for us, I think, is really getting to understand what drives our supporter relationship. So what motivates somebody to become a supporter of Macmillan, and then what kind of aspects do we need to respond to in order to keep them engaged and keep them supporting our cause. So very much picking up on what Peter was saying, that supporter journey, understanding that we as fundraisers need to kind of break out of our silos and stop thinking about people as you know, Race for Life participants or Coffee Morning hosts or direct debit supporters, and actually think about them as multifaceted people who've come to our cause, who are interested in what it is that we exist to do, and give them as many opportunities to keep engaged, stay engaged for the long term, because that's going to be profitable for us.
Martin, it's keeping people interested, but also, I guess, continually demonstrating impact.
That's right. And I think part of keeping people interested is demonstrating impact. I mean, there's a kind of growing cohort of people and donors. I wouldn't say yet it's the majority, but a growing number of people who want to see how charities spend their money and what that money achieves. And we're facing a real problem in the UK in terms of a decline in the number of people giving. 1 in 7 of the population has stopped giving in the last 10 years. So the backdrop for many individual organisations, as we kind of stutter out of the recession, is really quite a worrying long-term secular trend, particularly of young people not engaging with charities. And we think we need new ways of doing that. And I think demonstrating impact is a crucial part of that.
Peter, at Kidney Research UK, presumably it's important to reach beyond people who are personally affected by kidney disease.
Absolutely. We do have, obviously, a proportion of supporters who have some connection with kidney disease, but it's actually quite a surprisingly low percentage of people supporting us. And we have a reasonable view of individual givers who are probably supporting us and two or three other health charities because these people are concerned. They wish to support charities that are going to push forward medical research and make life better for a lot of people affected by these conditions. The trick for us has got to be making people aware of the extent of the problem of kidney disease, getting that message over, and encouraging supporters to understand that this is a a critical, important thing, and that's worthy of support. And for us, that's really our strategy, is to try and acquire more supporters and get more people giving to help us double our income, triple our impact on kidney disease.
Clara, the cancer field might appear to be quite a crowded one in terms of charity fundraising. How do you distinguish your cell, your brand?
We were very fortunate last year. We were voted the public's number one charity brand. So we know that there's a huge amount of trust and affection for Macmillan Cancer Support out there already. And we work very closely with lots of other cancer charities, certainly with Cancer Research UK and with smaller cancer charities that exist to help specific types, people dealing with specific types of cancers. I think ultimately it's about us continuously saying we're here to help people who are diagnosed and living with cancer today. So to get that message across, to explain to people that we're here to support people in many different ways, and we have a brand advertising campaign that's out at the moment doing exactly that. As fundraisers, I think it's critical for us to be as passionate and knowledgeable on the cause and on the range of ways that we need to meet the challenges people living with cancer face as any of our colleagues who deliver that support. And I think that's vital. It's going to be increasingly important if we're going to demonstrate our impact, and we have to do that as fundraisers in every interaction that we have with people who are either supporting us already or who have the potential to support us.
Martin, some charities presumably are a lot better at this than others.
Yes, including Macmillan. I think Macmillan has gone a long way in recent years to investing in this area, recognising that it's difficult to do well, too difficult to do properly, but it's a journey partly of discovery about how you measure, articulate and then communicate your impact to your supporters, and then grow their support and add on more supporters. But I would single out Macmillan as one example that's done it well, imperfectly, but there is no perfect way of doing it. It's about putting effort into it and committing resources to it. And I think if you do that, you can make real progress.
And where do you sit, Martin, see the future of fundraising going? Is it about the individual, or is it going to be more about corporate backing? Or is it indeed going to be more about contract income?
I think for the near future, it's got to be more about individual giving. As I say, rekindling interest amongst private givers and dealing with a kind of wave of public sector spending cuts, which is already hitting and hurting charities enormously. And we're seeing very sweeping cuts affecting kind of all sizes of charities across the UK, and that's going to continue for a long time. It's very hard to see, I think, corporate giving picking up materially. There's been a long-term secular decline in corporate giving. Some charities manage to tap into it very well, many don't. Increasingly, corporates want to tie in their giving to marketing, and that narrows the field of charities that really can benefit from it. So I think it's a mixture of individual giving, and in the long term, as if the idea of the big society really takes off, then contract income and commissioning may grow again, but that's really once we get through the spending cuts.
Clara, how are Macmillan doing in terms of tapping into online fundraising? Is that an exciting new frontier for you?
It's interesting, actually, seeing how online fundraising or digital fundraising has evolved over the last few years. We used to treat it as, and I say we as fundraisers, not just at Macmillan, but we used to treat it as something very separate, that we would, you know, those of us who came from traditional direct marketing backgrounds or event fundraising backgrounds or community fundraising backgrounds weren't entirely sure how to deal with. And now, increasingly, it's another channel that just forms part of the mix, you know, whether it's a way for people to respond or register, whether it's a way for people, supporters to communicate with each other, or a channel for them to get in touch with us and tell us what they think. So it absolutely is a critical part of the mix, and increasingly it just becomes it's a component of everything that we do.
Is that the same for you, Peter?
It is a channel. You know, the internet is not full of people queuing up to give you money. You have to use that integrated with your other asks in order to make it easier and to match the supporters' motivations to give. Social media has become a very important thing, and I think for us, certainly in our own way, we communicate by the web. We have email, obviously, but the growth certainly in Facebook and Twitter and YouTube has enabled our supporters to drive the content and drive the agenda. And the pitfall in that is you must not treat social media in a corporate way. Mm-hmm. You must treat social media as any individual would, and you're there to facilitate a conversation and an online community between your supporters and let them drive the agenda. And in a way, we find that a lot of our outcomes, Martin, can come out in those conversations, and we find that we have people online starting whole new threads of discussion where we can actually throw in information about the organisation.
There's an element of letting go as well, I think, for digital fundraising, which is, it feels a bit nerve-wracking, but it's fantastic to see those kind of relationships being built between supporters and enthusiasm being generated and built up between supporters without us necessarily doing anything other than facilitating those kind of discussions.
A slight loss of control.
Yes, but a fantastic one. A really rewarding
Absolutely.
One.
No, I agree. You do not control the social media space. If you try to control that social media space, you've missed the point, I think.
Martin, just coming back to you finally, perhaps, you've got a very interesting background for somebody in this sector. Before you joined New Philanthropy Capital, you were an economist at Goldman Sachs, and before that, an economist at the Bank of England. How does that perspective inform your work in the sector?
Well, some people would think that means that I don't know much about the sector at all and that I shouldn't be allowed to have any opinions about the sector, or the opinions I have I have no validity. I think it means, basically, being an economist means you do approach things, A, very analytically, and hopefully without any loss of understanding of emotion, but also B, with a quite a strong bias towards being quantitative and wanting to measure things. And I am quite a sort of measurement fundamentalist. I think lots of things that charities do that aren't measured can be measured and can be very usefully and productively measured. So that's the kind of the bias that I bring to it. And I also think to an extent about the way that charities work as a marketplace, not in an ideological sense, but because markets are things that economists can understand, sort of frameworks they can understand. And increasingly, fundraising is a very competitive marketplace. And you see that all the time. There is a sort of competition, even within the new media space, for attention from people and an evolving marketplace there. So that's the sort of biases and prejudices, frankly, that I bring to bear.
Thanks very much. Measurement fundamentalist. I love that. I love that phrase. Whether it's clothing, books, household wares, or children's toys, there can't be many people who haven't dipped into a charity shop for a nose around and the chance of nabbing a bargain. And with the recent endorsement by Dame Helen Mirren, with the recent BBC Two series fronted by retail expert Mary Portas, and with an 8% year-on-year jump in profits, charity shop business does seem to be booming. With that in mind, I've been rooting through the bargain bins to find out how the beloved charity shop sits in the fundraising mix of today. So here I am, surrounded by bags of donated clothes and books and all sorts of things. There's some saucepans over here. We're in the storeroom of the British Heart Foundation charity shop in Camden in North London, and the storeroom where all the donated items are sorted and cleaned before they're being put out on display in the main shop. I'm joined by Warren Alexander, who's the chief executive of the Association of Charity Shops, and Debbie Dixon, who's the British Heart Foundation regional manager for London and the South East. Debbie, BHF has been opening a lot of charity shops in recent months. I think it opened more last year than any other charity. Why is it so important to the charity?
You're right, we have opened lots of shops, and certainly more than any other charity. It's important for us, we feel, because the British Heart Foundation, we want our customers and anyone who's had anything to do with heart problems to actually think of their shop on their local high street. We believe by having our name on the high street raises awareness of what we do, which is at the end of the day is helping to save lives.
How important is the income from charity shops as part of the overall fundraising strategy of the organisation?
The fundraising that we do is now actually 24% of the entire income of the British Heart Foundation, so it really is a vital part of the business.
Warren Alexander, is that typical for the bigger charities?
That is pretty typical. It will clearly vary from charity to charity, but the income that they get from their charity retailing is a very, very important part of their charitable income, particularly because it's not restricted to any particular project. It allows the charity to do with it what they feel is best, and it is certainly important in raising awareness about the charity in the wider community.
And are all charity shops the same, or do different charities take different approaches, have different places in the market with their shops.
They certainly do take different places. There is an increasing trend for some charities to have specialist shops, whether they be books or furniture or vintage clothes and things like that. And each charity will have its own retailing and business model, which is clearly very important. And there will always be a difference between the large national charities and regional charities and hospices in the way they do their business, the way they communicate what they're doing with their local community and the purposes for which they're raising their money.
What's been the impact of the recession? I guess on one hand, you'd expect demand for the goods to grow. But on the other hand, what's been the effect on donated goods?
It's an interesting question. It's really very difficult to know exactly how the recession has affected trade. We certainly know in the past year that overall charity shops have done well. Growth is continuing, and of course that's very, very encouraging. But we also know that there's been a lot of pressure on donations of goods to charity shops, and that is worrying in the longer term. We're not terribly sure whether it's exactly to do with the recession or whether it's to do with a mix of other things, such as the fashion chains on the high street that are selling lower cost goods and make it more difficult for charity shops to sell. But certainly there is a pressure on the donations of goods to charity shops.
Debbie Dixon, what's the picture at British Heart Foundation? Have you found it more difficult to get goods to sell?
Yes, we have seen a drop in our donations, mainly those via our van collections. And this has been down to a lot of commercial collectors who are actually out there taking bags. And obviously, we've tried to raise the awareness of this. And we ask that anybody who puts a bag out on the high street ensures that it's to a charity that actually has shops, just so that you know that the stock you're giving is actually going to end up in a shop rather than being perhaps sold out to Eastern European.
You've got a big collection drive on at the moment, I understand. That's looking behind me here in the storeroom, there's bags piling up. That looks as if it's been quite successful.
This is our second year of this campaign. We call it the Big Donation, and absolutely, it's been very, very successful. Our aim is to bring in something like 400,000 bags, which is equivalent for us of £8 million.
Warren, there's been a sort of a recent, I suppose, charity shop chic would be the term. There's been the Mary Portas series on television. Has that, do you think, elevated the status of charity shop shopping?
I think it certainly made people more aware of the advantages of charity shop and the range of stuff they can buy in them. Charity shops themselves are becoming increasingly professional. They're competing on the high street with other stores to some extent. They have to be professional in order to get their customers in. They do a very good job, and people enjoy shopping in charity shops, and I think that's why they're so successful.
Warren Alexander, Debbie Dixon, thank you very much. They're getting ready to put the winter stock out here in Camden. I can see a box of gloves over there, which reminds me I could do with some gloves, and I'm going to rummage through that just now. Thanks very much. So, Clara, do you enjoy charity shop shopping?
I do. I can remember my first day at university, actually, I think from photographs, probably my entire time at university was spent wearing a jacket that I bought in a charity shop. And actually, they kind of hold a dear place for me. When my dad died 4 years ago of heart disease, my mum found volunteering at her local BHF shop a really helpful way of giving something back. So I'm a big believer in charity shops.
Peter, Kidney Research UK has a few charity shops.
We have a few shops. We were a late entrant into the charity retail market, and if you're a late entrant, it's very hard to make an impression. We've kept a few shops. They are relatively successful, and we found that we've had a heavy level of donations to those shops. Turnover has been good. I just wanted to sort of return to a remark that was made in that last piece, actually, which worried me slightly, about supporters should be urged to give to a charity that has charity shops. And this kind of flies a face in a bit about what we were saying about supporters and giving them the choice. And I think that there are commercial collections, as we know, of materials which go to raise money for charities. We happily run both models. We have a chain of charity shops and we do recycling collections through a partner. And we are quite happy to run both systems. And I think it is dangerous territory to suggest to the supporter that only giving to a charity shop is a better thing.
Martin, have you done any evaluation of that issue?
No, we haven't. That makes me want to do it and start a research project about that. So no, we haven't done any detailed work on charity shops. My only experience from charity shops is a direct one of living very close to one in South London run by Trinity Hospice, which is hugely successful and I think pretty much a kind of cash cow for the charities. It's based near Clapham Common. And it also serves a very good purpose in terms of highlighting the charity within the community. And it gets a lot of attention in terms of supporters signing up for sponsored runs and other events by being on the high street and having a very visible presence on the high street. So it's money, and also, as we heard in that report, it's profile and indirect benefits to the organisation. But no, we haven't done analysis, and I think it's actually quite an interesting area to do some.
Okay, we'll come back to you when you've done that. Charity street collectors, or chuggers, charity muggers as they're often branded, have come in for some flack in recent weeks. Sometimes perceived by shoppers as aggressive and confrontational, they're never going to win any popularity contests, but with many big-name charities employing such techniques, they're certainly an important part of the fundraising approach. Ian McQuillan of the Public Fundraising Regulatory Association offers his defence of the humble fundraiser.
Hardly anyone connected with fundraising can have failed to be aware of Newsnight's so-called investigation into face-to-face fundraising. It took at least three researchers more than a month to come to the same conclusion, that fundraising agencies are paid and that the amount they are paid is about the same as the donor gives to charity in their first year, as did a similar investigation by Radio 4's Moneybox programme in 2003. The BBC could have saved themselves a decent chunk of licence fee revenue simply by searching their own website. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was bemoaning to a charity sector journalist how fed up I was that having to explain over and over again to journalists the same facts about face-to-face fundraising. Ever eager for a new spin, she shot back, "Is that because they don't get it or because you don't explain it well enough?" I must admit, I got a bit frustrated with her. I've been explaining and championing face-to-face long before it was ever my job at the PFRA. So, of course, the journos didn't get it. I mean, you just got to look at the Newsnight piece. You might say I'm biased, yet it was truly an execrable piece of broadcast journalism. I spoke to the producer at length. I explained that all fundraising methods have a cost, for which there is a period of time before the money given by a new donor has paid off the cost of their recruitment. I pointed out that much, if not most, fundraising from individuals, direct mail, telephone, DRTV, press advertising, telephone and the like, is contracted out to third-party fundraising agencies, just like face-to-faces. I explained that the individual cost per acquisition for many of these is higher, much higher in some cases, than for face-to-face. He didn't want to know, and you've seen the outcome for yourselves. But this whole Newsnight episode has forced me to rethink whether fundraisers do explain face-to-face well enough. Only one charity was prepared to defend their use of face-to-face live on the programme. All the others ducked the issue. They did the same thing 7 years ago with Moneybox, when this lack of action by charities led to Shelter's then fundraising director Alan Goschalk to set up the Impact Coalition. Yet, 7 years on, nothing's changed. The media come with the intention of soundly bashing us with the wrong end of the stick, and no one in the charity sector has the gumption to wrest it from them and hit back. Organisations such as the PFRA can only do so much in explaining how face-to-face works. Ultimately, it's up to the charities that use face-to-face to defend it. Somebody in the charity sector has to accept responsibility to actively and combatively, where necessary, explain to journalists why charities use face-to-face and not be afraid to challenge their ridiculously naive preconceptions that charities should not spend money on fundraising. A great opportunity to influence public perception has been squandered.
Tough talk there from Ian McQuillan. Now, Peter, you're something of a neutral in this area because you don't actually do face-to-face fundraising.
No, we don't. And we've looked into it in the past, and the jury's still out, and we may well use it as a acquisition product in the future. I think that the comments there were interesting, and I think that he's quite right that the charity sector is not only poor at defending that issue, but I think is quite poor at trying to manage its environment. So I think we have a responsibility as a sector to stand up and talk about what we do. And I think why people were frightened, were they frightened? I don't know. To go on and talk about how much it costs to recruit a donor, I don't know. Face-to-face, yes, there's a cost. You can find out that some charities pay £100 per donor. you know, have we done the calculations on how much advertising is done by charities? Have we done the calculations on how much money is spent on outbound telephone canvassing to try and get new donors? Yet these things have not caught the attention. And we all know, we're preaching to the converted in this conversation, I'm sure, but it costs money to get a new customer, as it does in the commercial sector. And we shouldn't be frightened of saying that.
Clara, why do you think there is an apparent reluctance on the part of charities to defend this form of fundraising?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's unfortunate because we do ourselves a disservice. You know, we're trying very hard in very challenging circumstances to do a really good job to generate much needed funds. And that's a professional business. You know, it requires us to marry passion and enthusiasm for our cause with the professionalism that means that we're using the investment in fundraising in a really wise and intelligent way. So we shouldn't be frightened of pulling the curtain back a bit on the kind of Wizard of Oz thing and just saying, you know what, when we carry out an event, when we mail an appeal, when we phone somebody, there is a cost associated with that, and it's worth bearing that cost in order to generate a new supporter who can stay with us for a long time and help us achieve our ambition.
Martin, I mean, we've been talking for years about the need for greater transparency on the costs of fundraising, but there still seem to be issues around this in the sector.
There are still issues around it, and I find this a little bit depressing. I think my sense is that the reason that chugging, I mean, let's call it what ordinary people call this is not face-to-face fundraising, they call it chugging. And I get abusive emails from heads of fundraising charities when I write something and I write the word chuggers in a piece, as we did a few years ago. I got included from Alan Goschalk, who was referenced in that piece just now. I think the issue that chugging gets people vexed is that most people don't like it. It's good for charities to raise money, but most ordinary people do not like being accosted in the street and being asked to sign up for a charity. They simply don't like it. I'm very comfortable if a charity that I support calls me at home and asks me whether or not I'm satisfied with the level of donation that I give to them, which is code for, do you want to give us more? I will invariably give them more money if they ask for it. And I think, as fundraisers will tell you, the first rule of fundraising is make the ask. But the activity of chugging annoys a lot of people in this country and I think actually damages charities' reputation, is my personal view. And I think the reason that charity chief execs wouldn't come on that programme and Newsnight and defend it is because I think deep down many of them know that people don't like it. It may be that charities have to do it, but people don't really like it.
On that challenging note, I'm afraid the time has defeated us. I'm sure we'll return to this issue in future. If you have views about face-to-face fundraising or chugging, as Martin says we must call it, email us charityeffectiveness@guardian.co.uk. I'd like to thank Martin Brooks, Clara Avery, Peter Story, Warren Alexander and Debbie Dixon for their contributions to this programme. And thanks also to my producers at Sound Delivery. I'm David Brindle, The Guardian's Public Services Editor, and you've been listening to the Charity Effectiveness Podcast, brought to you by Society Guardian and knowhownonprofit.org. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.